If you love to travel, Capital One has a rewards credit card that's perfect for you. With the Capital One Venture X card, you earn unlimited double miles on everything you buy. Plus, you get premium benefits at a collection of luxury hotels when you book on Capital One Travel. And with Venture X, you get access to over 1,000 airport lounges worldwide. Open up a world of travel possibilities with the Capital One Venture X card. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.
Welcome to The Deep Dive. Today, we are tackling a colossal subject, India.
A truly colossal subject, a nation, a civilization. It's a lot to unpack.
Right. And it's a place that has, you know, completely reshaped the global population map. It became the world's most populous country just back in 2023.
And since its independence in 1947, it's been the world's most populous democracy. That's a huge part of the story.
It is. And we have an immense stack of sources to get through today. We're looking at millennia of history, this tectonic scale geography, and the incredible complexity of its modern politics and culture.
It's a continuous history stretching back five millennia. Almost impossible to grasp.
So our mission today is to give you that intellectual shortcut. We're going to synthesize the most critical nuggets from all these sources so you can get a quick, thorough understanding of India's defining characteristics.
And its profound dualities. I think that's a key theme we'll keep coming back to.
Absolutely. So where do we start?
I think we have to start with identity, with names. Because in India, names tell a story. There are three powerful names for this nation: India, Farat, and Hindustan.
Okay, let's unpack the one we all know first, India. I think a lot of people, myself included, always assumed this was purely a colonial name.
Man, that's a common misconception, but the roots go much, much deeper.
Deeper than the British Empire.
Oh, way deeper. The immediate root is classical Latin India. That was the term Europeans used for this vast, kind of mysterious region from South Asia toward China.
Okay.
But if you trace that back, the ultimate source is the Sanskrit word Sindhu.
Sindhu just means river, right?
Exactly. Specifically, the Indus River, the cradle of that first great urban civilization. The ancient Greeks heard this and called the people of the region the Indoi.
So the people of the Indus.
Literally. So the global name for the country is really just a linguistic echo of its most ancient geographical anchor.
That's fascinating. So we have Farat. This is the name used in the Constitution of India, so it has a very different, more internal resonance.
It does. Farat comes from the historical term Bharatvarsha. It really gained political and cultural traction as a native name in the mid-19th century during the nationalist movements.
And did Bharatvarsha always refer to the whole country?
Originally, it just applied to North India. But today, it's used as this powerful, unifying name for the entire nation, one that's rooted in indigenous epics and stories.
And finally, Hindustan. This one feels very imperial, maybe Mughal.
You're spot on. Hindustan is a Middle Persian name. It became really popular around the 13th century after Muslim armies established rule in the north.
And what does it mean?
It literally translates to land of Hindus. But its meaning shifted over time. Sometimes it meant just the northern subcontinent, other times the whole country. It really marks that period of medieval Islamic rule and cultural synthesis.
So you have three names. And they're basically three different historical timelines in a word.
Exactly. They aren't just labels. They're windows into how the world and India itself saw this land over thousands of years.
Those timelines are a perfect transition into the deep history. We're not just talking recorded history here. We're talking about human history on a, well, a massive scale. How far back are we going for Homo sapiens?
The timeline is just immense. Modern humans arrived from Africa remarkably early. The estimates put the window between about 80,000 and 50,000 years ago.
80,000.
With really strong evidence suggesting they were settled by at least 55,000 years ago. Probably came along the coast of southern Asia.
55 millennia. It's almost impossible to wrap your head around that amount of time for a population to evolve and diverge.
And that's the key. That long, long duration, spent mostly in isolation as hunter-gatherers, that's the foundational reason the region became and still is so incredibly diverse, genetically, culturally, linguistically.
And we have physical evidence for this.
We do. The earliest known modern human fossils found in South Asia date to about 30,000 years ago. It's a truly unbroken chain of human presence.
And that hunter-gatherer existence eventually gives way to settled life. This takes us to the famous Indus Valley Civilization.
Right. But even before the great cities, settled life began about 9,000 years ago in the Indus River Basin with small agricultural villages. And over thousands of years, this gradually evolved into the Indus Valley civilization.
South Asia's first urban culture.
And one of the world's most advanced at the time. We're talking about the great cities like Mohenjo-Daro and Harappa, which were flourishing between 2500 and 1900 BCE.
What made them so sophisticated? I mean, beyond just being big cities.
Their level of organization was just astounding. They had standardized weights and measures. They had advanced urban planning with grid systems and, you know, sanitation and drainage systems that were better than what you'd see in parts of Europe centuries later.
And they weren't isolated.
Not at all. They were major traders. We have evidence of extensive trade with Mesopotamia all the way to Central Asia, a very connected, very complex society.
So after the eventual decline of the Indus Valley, we see the rise of the next foundational culture, the Vedic Age.
Exactly. By about 1200 BCE, you see an archaic form of Sanskrit, which is an Indo-European language, start to diffuse into the region from the northwest.
And this linguistic shift is so important because...
Because the hymns of the Vedas were composed during this time. These are the oldest scriptures of Hinduism, and they record the very early philosophical and religious structures of the faith.
And with that philosophy comes the social structure that has... in many ways, defined India ever since, the caste system.
It did. By around 400 BCE, the caste system, or Varna, had really formalized within Hinduism. It established this very rigid hereditary hierarchy.
Can you break that down for us?
It divided society into a strict stratification. You had the priests or Brahmin at the top, then warders and administrators, the Kshatriya. Below them, free peasants and merchants, the Vaishya, and then the service class, the Shudra.
And it was designed to exclude certain groups.
Right. It explicitly excluded many indigenous peoples and formalized this concept of ritual purity that was tied directly to your birth.
But that kind of rigidity, it often sparks a reaction, a rebellion.
On a massive one. That's the critical contrast here. The 6th century BCE was this explosion of new intellectual and religious thought. You have the simultaneous rise of Buddhism, founded by Gautama Buddha, and Jainism, associated with Mahavira.
And what were they offering?
An alternative. A social order that was completely unlinked to heredity or ritual sacrifice. They proclaimed that your spiritual attainment was not determined by who your parents were.
That's a radical, almost democratic spiritual idea for the time.
Absolutely radical.
Yeah.
And they found a lot of support among merchants, among people who felt constrained by the Vedic order. They established these long-lasting monastic traditions that challenged the idea that birthright was everything.
And all this intellectual ferment is happening just as we start to see real political consolidation.
Exactly. Which brings us to the first great empires. The Maurya and the Gupta.
Let's start with the Maurya.
The Maurya Empire created the largest political entity the subcontinent had ever seen. The reign of Ashoka is just monumental. He expanded the empire through conquest, but then famously renounced militarism and embraced the Buddhist concept of Dhamma, or moral conduct.
He set a kind of template for moral governance.
He did. Even if the empire itself was a bit loose-knit, that idea of a moral ruler persisted in memory for centuries.
And after the Maurya, we get the Gupta era, often called India's Golden Age.
Right. From the 4th to 6th centuries CD, the Guptas perfected the system of decentralized administration in the Ganges Plain. It became a blueprint for later kingdoms. Hinduism also reasserted itself during this period.
But there's that duality again. This era of incredible creativity also had a darker side.
It did.
Yeah.
This is when we see the formal decline in the status of women and the organization of untouchability becomes deeply, deeply ingrained in social practice. A golden age for some, but not for all.
And while all this is happening in the north, we can't forget the south. It had a completely different trajectory.
A very different and equally important one. The deep south was ruled by powerful kingdoms like the Cheras, the Cholas, and the Pandyas. The sources make it clear they were major trading powers with links to the Roman Empire.
And they were cultural exporters.
Hugely important cultural exporters. They spread Dravidian language scripts, Hindu temple architecture, and religious ideas all throughout Southeast Asia. They laid the cultural foundations for kingdoms in places we now know as Indonesia and Cambodia.
Which brings us to the medieval crossroads, when India becomes this port of entry for global faiths.
That's a perfect way to put it. In the first millennium CE, long before any major armies arrived, Islam, Christianity, Judaism, and Zoroastrianism all became established on India's coasts. purely through trade, India was already a cosmopolitan meeting place of ideas and faiths.
But the major political power shift came later, with the armies from Central Asia.
Yes. In the early second millennium, Muslim armies overran the northern plains, and that led to the establishment of the Delhi Sultanate in 1206. This was a profound geopolitical event.
What way?
It integrated northern India into the vast cosmopolitan networks of the medieval Islamic world. Suddenly, Delhi was connected by trade, scholarship, and administration to places like Baghdad, Cairo, and Samarkand.
Was this seen as purely a disruptive conquest?
It was a complex mix. It was definitely disruptive for the old Indian elites. But the Sultanate was also pragmatic. For the most part, they allowed the massive non-Muslim population to follow their own customs.
And they played another crucial role historically.
An invaluable one. They successfully repulsed the devastating Mongol raids in the 13th century. They basically spared the subcontinent the fate that befell West and Central Asia.
And that stability allowed for new cultural forms to emerge.
Precisely. You had soldiers, scholars, mystics, artists, all fleeing the Mongol devastation and migrating into India. This created this rich, syncretic Indo-Islamic culture in the north.
And what was happening in the south at this time?
In the south, the indigenous Vijayanagara Empire consolidated power. It created this long-lasting composite Hindu culture that maintained a very distinct southern identity.
The sources also mention the emergence of another major religion around this time.
Yes, Sikhism. It emerged in the Punjab region as a powerful new faith, one that rejected the institutionalized ritualism of the prevailing religions and advocated for a more direct spiritual connection, another foundational layer to India's incredible spiritual mosaic.
Which brings us to the political zenith of this whole period. The Mughal Empire.
The Mughals, again from Central Asia, arrived in the early 16th century. Initially, their dominance was military. They were masters of cavalry and gunpowder. But their lasting success was institutional.
How so?
Unlike a lot of conquerors, they didn't try to just stamp out local societies. They perfected this system of systematic, centralized, and surprisingly uniform rule over this incredibly diverse land.
How do they manage to hold it all together?
They balanced local power structures, they used new administrative practices, and brought in diverse ruling elites, including many non-Muslims demanding loyalty to the emperor, and the stability that they created. It fueled an economic revolution.
And that revolution was built on silver.
This is one of the most critical insights from the sources. The Mughal government mandated that most land taxes, the main source of revenue, had to be paid in regulated silver currency.
What was the effect of that?
It was transformative. It forced millions of peasants and artisans who had previously worked in local barter systems directly into a huge regulated market economy. It fueled two centuries of immense economic expansion, long-distance trade, and created the wealth for the stunning architectural legacy they left behind.
The power of a single currency. It's incredible. Okay, before we move to the colonial era, let's talk about the physical foundations.
Yeah.
The sheer geological force that built this subcontinent.
You have to understand, India sits on its own planet-sized engine, the Indian tectonal plate. About 70 million years ago, it broke off from the supercontinent Gondwana and started this rapid, massive drift to the northeast.
And this drift ended in a monumental collision.
The defining physical event in India's story. The Indian continental crust just rammed into the Eurasian plate. The crust piled up, it sheared, it thickened, and that process, called orogeny, created the Himalayas.
So the Himalayas are literally the result of India running into Asia.
Exactly. And that collision also created the country's other major geographical zones. South of the Himalayas, the plate movement created this vast, deep trough.
And that trough became what?
Over millennia, it was filled with sediment from the rivers, creating the incredibly fertile but also geologically volatile Indo-Gangetic Plain.
And how is that different from the south, peninsular India?
Peninsular India, the Deccan Plateau, is the oldest, most geologically stable part of the country. We're talking rocks over a billion years old. It's the subcontinent's ancient, unmoving anchor.
And all that water from the Himalayas has to go somewhere.
It does. It feeds the major rivers, the Ganges and the Brahmaputra, which drain into the Bay of Bengal. But you have to look at a river like the Kosi, a tributary of the Ganges, to understand the plain's volatility.
Why the Kosi specifically?
Because of all the silt deposition, it has an extremely low gradient. It can't cut a stable channel, so it deposits more silt, raises its own bed, and then bursts its banks and shifts its course dramatically,
causing devastating floods.
Exactly. They call it the Sorrow of Bihar. for a reason. It's a constant destructive pattern.
And these huge geographical features, the mountains, the desert, they control the climate. They create the monsoon.
It's a beautiful, powerful mechanism. The Himalayas act like a giant wall, blocking the cold Central Asian winds and keeping the subcontinent much warmer than it should be. At the same time, the Thar Desert in the west heats up and attracts the moisture-laden southwest summer monsoon winds.
And that monsoon is everything.
It is the lifeblood of the country. It provides most of the annual rainfall between June and October. Its timing, its intensity, the entire economy depends on it.
But that reliable system is now under serious threat from climate change.
The data is pretty stark. India's average temperature has gone up by 0.7 degrees Celsius since 1901. The most immediate and frankly terrifying consequence is the retreat of the Himalayan glaciers.
The source of the major rivers.
The source of the rivers. Their loss will have a massive adverse impact on long-term river flow. And the projections suggest a serious increase in both the number and the severity of droughts by the end of this century.
A huge threat to water and food security. And before we move on, let's just touch on the incredible biodiversity of this land.
Right. India is what's called a megadiverse country. It has an extraordinary density of life. Nearly 9% of all mammals and almost 14% of all bird species on the planet.
And a lot of this life is unique to India.
It is. It's a land of endemism. A full third of all Indian plant species are found nowhere else on Earth. And it has four of the world's 34 biodiversity hotspots.
Which are areas of high diversity, but also significant habitat loss.
Making the conservation challenges really acute. You have 172 IUCN-designated threatened animal species. We all know about the Bengal tiger, whose numbers have recovered a bit to around 3,000. But others, like the Ganges River dolphin, are still critically threatened.
And there's that one tragic story that really highlights the unintended consequences of human action. The vultures.
That story is a textbook case of an ecological catastrophe. The Indian white-rumped vulture is now critically endangered. It was nearly wiped out because it was eating the carrion of cattle that had been treated with an anti-inflammatory drug.
Diclofenac.
Diclofenac. Harmless to cattle, but lethally toxic to the vultures. It caused kidney failure and a massive, massive population collapse. A stark reminder of how fragile these ecosystems are.
Okay, so that brings us to the modern era. The Mughal Empire, built on that silver currency and administrative genius, eventually fractured. And that fragmentation opened the door for colonial transformation.
It did. Multiple European powers had trading posts, but it was the English East India Company that really leveraged the local divisions. After the Battle of Plassey in 1757, they secured control of the wealthy Bengal region, and by the 1820s, they were the sovereign power.
And the most immediate impact of their rule was a total economic reversal for India.
A total reversal. For centuries, India had been a major global exporter of fine manufactured goods like textiles. Under the company, it was transformed into a colonial economy designed to do one thing.
Supply raw materials to Britain.
Exactly. Supply Britain with raw materials, cotton, jute, spices, and serve as a captive market for British manufactured goods.
Yeah.
It systematically dismantled local industry.
And the company's rule was ended by a massive, violent explosion of resentment in 1857.
The Indian Rebellion, a pivotal moment. It wasn't a single unified movement, but a convergence of all these deep-seated resentments. Harsh land taxes, invasive British social reforms, the annexation of princely states. It all boiled over.
And what was the immediate result of the rebellion?
It shook the British so badly that the Crown dissolved the East India Company and took direct administrative control in 1858. This is the start of the British Raj.
And they brought in technology like railways and the telegraph.
They did, but primarily for their own administrative and military purposes, to connect and control the vast territory more effectively.
But direct rule didn't exactly quell the unrest, did it?
Quite the opposite. It created this tension that ultimately galvanized the nationalist movement. The Indian National Congress was founded in 1885, the first major nationalist movement in the non-European parts of the British Empire.
And the key figure in that movement became, of course, Mahatma Gandhi.
Gandhi completely redefined the movement after 1920. His genius was mobilizing the masses through nonviolent resistance, or satyagraha. He turned it from a small urban elite movement into a mass movement. And that, ultimately, was what forced the British to leave.
But that moment of independence in 1947 was tied directly to the tragedy of partition.
An immense tragedy. The British Indian Empire was divided along religious lines into Hindu-majority India and Muslim-majority Pakistan. This led to unprecedented sectarian violence and the largest forced migration in human history. Maybe 1 million people lost their lives.
So stepping out of that incredible trauma, India had to build a government from scratch. How did they even begin?
The Constituent Assembly, led by figures like B.R. Ambedkar, was remarkably efficient. They adopted the Constitution in 1950, establishing India as a secular, democratic, federal parliamentary republic.
And they didn't start from a blank page.
No, they were pragmatic. They used the Government of India Act of 1935 as a core template, but they drew influences from all over the world.
Like where?
The section on fundamental rights, freedom of speech, equality before the law, was heavily influenced by the U.S. Constitution. But the directives on socioeconomic goals that the state should aim for, that was drawn from the Constitution of Ireland.
And they made a direct assault on the caste system.
A direct one. Article 17 formally abolished untouchability, a huge step in trying to dismantle that social scaffolding.
So let's clarify the power structure. Who actually runs the government?
The Prime Minister is the effective head of government. They have to command a majority in the Lok Sabha, the lower house of parliament, which is directly elected every 5 years. The president is the head of state, but it's a largely ceremonial role.
And the judiciary?
It's a three-tier independent system. You have the Supreme Court at the top, then 25 high courts, and then the huge network of trial courts. And the Supreme Court has the crucial power of judicial review.
Meaning it can strike down laws.
Exactly. It can strike down any law or government action it deems unconstitutional. A vital check on power.
For the first few decades after independence, the political landscape was just dominated by one party.
The Indian National Congress. Under Jawaharlal Nehru and later his daughter Indira Gandhi, they had an iron grip on power from 1950 all the way to the late 1980s. That era was defined by Nehruvian socialism and protectionist economic policies.
But that dominance eventually broke apart.
It did. The late 80s marked the end of the Congress majority, and India entered this really complex era of multi-party coalition governments. This period saw the rise of regional parties and, crucially, the rise of the right-wing Bharatiya Janata Party, the BJP.
And the BJP eventually broke that coalition cycle.
Decisively. Under Narendra Modi, the BJP won absolute majorities in 2014 and 2019, something no single party had done since 1984. It was a profound political shift towards strong, centralized power and a focus on Hindu nationalist identity.
Though the most recent election in 2024 changed that dynamic again.
It did. In 2024, the BJP was reduced to forming a coalition government, with Modi serving a third term. It just shows the complexity and vibrancy of Indian democracy.
Let's shift our gaze outward now. As this massive, newly independent nation, what was India's initial role on the world stage?
India immediately positioned itself as a moral and political leader. It was a huge supporter of decolonization across Africa and Asia, and it played a defining role in the non-aligned movement.
Trying to find a middle path in the Cold War.
Exactly, a path distinct from the Western and Soviet blocs, emphasizing sovereign foreign policy.
But its own neighborhood has always been defined by severe tension.
Extremely so. Relations with Pakistan have been tense since partition, with three major wars fought over the disputed territory of Kashmir, plus the 1971 war that led to the creation of Bangladesh.
And the relationship with China has been just as fraught.
The 1962 Sino-Indian War was a shocking military defeat for India, a real national humiliation. It forced a complete overhaul of its defense policy.
But the sources note an important counterpoint to that.
They do. Just 5 years later, in a 1967 border skirmish, India achieved a decisive military victory over China, showing just how quickly its military had matured. But the border disputes remain a major point of tension today.
And it was China's nuclear test that spurred India's own nuclear program.
Absolutely. China's test in 1964 was the catalyst. India conducted what it called a peaceful nuclear explosion in 1974, and then more tests in 1998, officially declaring itself a nuclear weapon state.
But India's nuclear doctrine is quite unique, isn't it? Especially since it hasn't signed the major treaties.
It's very distinct. India maintains a no first use policy and is developing a nuclear triad land, air, and sea launch capability as part of its minimum credible deterrence posture.
And why won't it sign the non-proliferation treaty?
India sees the NPT and the CTBT as flawed and discriminatory. that they effectively create a permanent class of nuclear haves and have-nots. But despite not signing, India has managed to secure civilian nuclear deals with the US, Russia, and France, getting unique waivers that acknowledge its responsible track record.
Let's bring this back to the economy. For decades, it was heavily regulated, the so-called license Raj.
That phrase captures it perfectly. Until 1991, the economy was very protectionist, influenced by Soviet-style central planning. Growth was slow, the economy was walled off, and it was just incredibly difficult for anyone to start a business.
And what forced the huge pivot in 1991?
An acute balance of payments crisis. The country was basically on the verge of default. That forced the government to undertake radical liberalization, dismantling the license Raj and opening the economy to the world.
And the results have been transformative, at least in terms of overall size.
Oh, absolutely. It's now the world's fifth largest economy, nominally, third by purchasing power parity. It's been one of the fastest growing major economies in the world for two decades. This has lifted hundreds of millions of people out of poverty.
But that's where we hit the paradox. The growth is immense, but the per capita wealth is still stubbornly low.
This is the critical duality of modern India. Despite that incredible aggregate growth, the per capita GDP is still only around $2,800, ranking it 136th in the world. And economic inequality has actually increased alongside the growth.
So what's driving this growth? It seems to have skipped the traditional manufacturing phase that we saw in East Asia.
That's a crucial point. India largely leaped over mass manufacturing and went straight to services. The service sector makes up over half of the GDP.
Why was it able to do that?
Because of its vast, English-speaking skilled labor force and its favorable time zone for serving Western markets.
So IT services are absolutely central to this.
Absolutely central. The IT sector is a huge part of the national GDP. But beyond digital services, India is a massive manufacturing power in specific areas. It's the world's third largest vehicle market now. And its role in global health is, well, it's profound.
You mean pharmaceuticals?
Exactly. It's the world's third largest pharma producer, but more importantly, it's the largest producer of generic medicines. It supplies something like 50 to 60% of the entire global demand for vaccines.
And we can't forget the diaspora.
They're an economic powerhouse. India received $100 billion in remittances in 2022, the highest in the world. That money is a vital stabilizing force for the economy.
And finally, energy. This is where the tension between development and the environment is most acute.
Palpable. India's electrical capacity is huge and renewable capacity is growing. But its massive reliance on coal is still the primary source of its greenhouse gas emissions, about 7% of the global total. The per-person rate is low, but the absolute scale is just immense.
Which brings us directly to demographics and public health. With a population now over 1.4 billion, how has the nation done on basic social markers?
There's been significant progress, no doubt. Life expectancy has jumped from under 50 in the 1970s to 72 today. Literacy has gone from about 16% at independence to over 74%. The population growth rate is also slowing down, which is a good sign.
But beneath those positive trends lies one of the most tragic social challenges: the massive gender imbalance.
This is a really sobering part of the source material. The sex ratio is profoundly skewed. Only 940 females for every 1,000 males. And this isn't natural. It's the result of a deep cultural bias.
A bias that leads to the phenomenon of missing women.
A staggering number. The practice of female infanticide and, more recently, sex-selective abortion has resulted in an estimated 63 million missing women between 1964 and 2014. And the number quadrupled in that period as technology like ultrasound became more available.
And the cost continues even for girls who were born.
Yes. The sources estimate that 21 million girls are considered unwanted by their families. They get less care, less nutrition, less attention. It just shows that despite all the economic progress, these deeply entrenched patriarchal norms are incredibly persistent.
And the sheer scale of the population seems to be overwhelming the country's ability to manage public health and environmental crises.
The burden of disease is immense. India has 26% of the world's tuberculosis cases, but the most immediate pervasive crisis is air pollution.
The statistics on air quality are just shocking.
They are. The sources confirm that the 10 most polluted cities in the world are all in India. Air pollution was estimated to have killed over 1.2 million Indians in 2017 alone. It's a public health emergency born directly from rapid carbon-intensive development.
Let's pivot now to the incredibly rich and often confounding cultural identity, starting with the sheer number of languages.
It's a living linguistic museum. There are 424 living indigenous languages. The vast majority belong to the Indo-Aryan family, like Hindi, but then you have the Dravidian family in the south, which is completely distinct.
So establishing an official language after independence must have been a political minefield.
A complete tightrope walk. The government declared Hindi as the official language, but delegates from the non-Hindi-speaking south vehemently resisted.
Which is why English is still so prominent.
Exactly. English was kept as an associate official language, initially as a temporary fix. But after widespread violent riots in the 1960s, the government made it clear that English would remain the de facto formal language of India. It was a practical necessity for national unity.
And they also recognize a whole host of regional languages.
Right. The Eighth Schedule recognizes 22 languages that the government is obligated to promote, including major regional ones, but also languages like Sanskrit and Urdu, which are valued for their immense cultural heritage.
Now on to religion. India is a secular state, but it's also the birthplace of four major world religions.
Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism, and Sikhism all originated there. The population is about 80% Hindu, but critically, it's also 14% Muslim. That gives India the third largest Muslim population in the world.
And within that religious landscape, we have to address the persistent institution of caste.
Caste is unique to India and rooted in Hindu tradition. It's a social system defined by endogamy marrying within your specific subcaste, or jati and hereditary occupation.
And even though untouchability was formally abolished in 1950, what's the reality today?
The law is clear, but the social reality is far more complex. Caste-based inequality, discrimination, segregation, and even horrific violence still persist, especially in rural areas and in social spheres like marriage and housing.
And how is the traditional family structured?
The traditional norm is the multi-generational patrilineal joint family, though nuclear families are becoming more common in cities, and marriages are still overwhelmingly arranged by families.
And that leads to a divorce rate that is just shockingly low.
It is. Less than 1 in 1,000 marriages ends in divorce, which reflects how marriage is seen as a contract between families, not just individuals. But the dark side is that child marriage is still tragically common in some rural areas.
Let's shift now to India's incredible contributions to global thought, focusing on the history of mathematics. It's just astounding.
It's foundational to the modern world. We're talking about a tradition that goes back to the first millennium BCE. The Sulba Sutras, for example, contain the earliest known verbal expression of the Pythagorean theorem.
But the truly game-changing contributions were the decimal system and the concept of zero.
This cannot be overstated. Indian mathematicians like Aryabhata and Brahmagupta made three epochal breakthroughs. First, the modern decimal number system. Second, the concept of zero as a number, not just a placeholder. And third, the rules for operating with negative numbers.
And this knowledge transformed global arithmetic.
It did. It was transmitted through the Middle East to Europe and replaced the cumbersome Roman numeral system. And you also have to mention the Kerala school in the 15th century, who developed concepts that predated the invention of calculus in Europe by 2 centuries.
Incredible. And that same kind of philosophical depth is visible in the art.
It is. The Indian sculpting style is unique. It's not about anatomical precision. It's about expressing prana, the essential life force, through these smooth, flowing forms.
And the most iconic example of that is?
Probably the Chola bronze sculptures from the south, especially the image of Shiva as Nataraja, the lord of dance. It just captures this incredible cosmic energy.
And you see the same roots in music and dance.
Absolutely. You have the two main classical music traditions, Hindustani in the north and Carnatic in the south. Both are based on the complex systems of raga for melody and tala for rhythm.
And dance is central, not just in temples, but in modern culture too.
It's fundamental to Indian cinema, to Bollywood. Those film dances are this incredible blend of classical moves, regional folk styles, and modern popular influences.
Okay, let's wrap up our cultural tour with the things that define daily life, cuisine and clothing.
The foundation of Indian cuisine is simple. A cooked cereal, like rice, or a flatbread like chapati, paired with savory dishes. What makes it unique is the complex spicing and the incredibly high rate of vegetarianism.
20 to nearly 40%.
Which has led to some of the most sophisticated vegetarian cuisines in the world.
And how did the Mughals influence the food?
They imported cooking techniques from Central and West Asia. Dishes like biryani, the technique of slow cooking, that's all part of the Mughal legacy.
And the global popularity of something like tandoori chicken.
That's a fascinating modern story. It really comes from the entrepreneurial activity of people who were displaced by the 1947 partition and who popularized the tandoor oven in cities like Delhi, and from there, the world.
And finally, clothing. A mix of the traditional and the modern.
Historically, it was draped clothing. The sari for women, the dhoti for men. Stitched clothes like the shalwar kameez became widespread after Muslim rule. Today, in the cities, you see a mix of everything, with Western clothing being very common, but traditional attire is still central to formal and family life.
What an incredible synthesis. We've gone from the Indus Valley through the genius of the Mughals, the trauma of colonization, and the economic pivot of 1991. It's a land of just massive geological power, immense population, and profound cultural depth.
I think the overwhelming takeaway from all the sources is the intensity of the dualities in contemporary India. It's a technological powerhouse, a leader in IT and generic medicine, but it struggles with these foundational public health crises like air pollution and persistent social inequality, from gender imbalance to caste discrimination.
It's that tension between ancient traditions and this rapid headlong rush into 21st century modernity.
That's the defining tension.
And that pace of progress, juxtaposed against those deep-seated challenges, brings us to our final provocative thought for you, the learner. India maintains an official no-first-use nuclear policy and a minimum credible deterrence doctrine, signaling its absolute commitment to great power status. Simultaneously, its reliance on coal and its struggle with air pollution create a public health crisis that costs over 1 million lives a year. Given these powerful yet conflicting capacities, global security, essential medicine production, and massive pollution, what specific area, like its domestic environmental policy versus its commitment to global climate diplomacy, will be the first to break under this immense tension, forcing a decisive global decision on India's future path?
That tension between sovereign ambition and the foundational needs of 1.4 billion people is perhaps the defining geopolitical question of the current century.
Thank you for sharing your sources with us. We hope this deep dive has provided you with a truly thorough and compelling view of this colossal and complex nation. We invite you to continue your exploration.